Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome to Going in Blind. I'm Zach Tidwell, and my guest today has quite the wild background. He grew up on a state-run psychiatric hospital, or on the grounds of a state-run psychiatric hospital in New York. And he recently wrote a book about it, but as interesting as that is, what I thought was even more interesting is the fact that he's actually an internationally recognized clinical psychologist. He's the director of clinical training for the clinical psychology program at John Jay College, and specifically a lot of his work focuses around stigma and treating people with serious mental illnesses. And on top of everything else, he is the co-creator, co-founder, co-developer of a treatment modality called narrative enhancement and cognitive therapy that I'm sure we will dive into today as well. But before we get into that, I do have a couple quick announcements. I do have a book on the way. It's probably still about a year out. I'm going through a couple rounds of editing with my editor. But for those of you who haven't listened to the show and aren't familiar with me yet, I do have quite the background story as well. And I've seen that sharing my story can save lives. So I wrote a memoir about it. And you can learn a little bit more about that and also sign up for my newsletter to get announcements about it as it is coming into the world on my website at zachtidwell.com. And finally, please, if you get something out of this conversation, take a second to leave a rating and review. That helps me continue to grow the show and attract incredible guests like my guests today. So without any further delay, please welcome Dr. Philip Yanos.
So much, Zach. Really great honor to be on your show.
Yeah, I told you we were going to jump right into this. So how the hell does one end up growing up on the grounds of a state-run psychiatric hospital? I figured this goes, you're either your parents were mental health professionals or somehow your parents were locked up there.
Yeah, so my father was a professional. He was a psychiatrist. And this particular hospital is located on an island that's technically, you know, part of Manhattan, but it's separate from it. You can, you know, get there on an off-ramp from a bridge that goes to Queens and Bronx, right? So it's called the Triborough Bridge. My father, you know, was starting his career. He kind of went into medicine later in life because he was in this generation, this World War II generation, where he was in Europe, he came back, he was working in the garment industry that his family was in, and he kind of decided when he was in his 30s that he wanted to, you know, do his dream of being a doctor. So he went to Europe, got trained because there was affordable opportunities there at that time, came back to New York where he was born. And so the discipline he went into was psychiatry, which was made the most sense for someone who was his age because he was already, you know, about 40 when he graduated. And he found this opportunity to work at the state hospital. And they said, hey, you know, you could live on the grounds. We have these houses or cottages that were built in the, you know, 1920s or so. And he was like, you know, cool. You know, I have young kids. We were just born, you know, right before he started working there. And he thought this was a good opportunity to have his family in a house, you know, technically within the city, and then have like a little 5-minute drive to his job. But we were basically on this isolated island, you know, where there's no stores, there's no, you know, nothing going on except the hospital and then a lot of beautiful open space. So we had that opportunity, you know, even though, you know, we were technically in the city.
And it's, I was reading into Ward's Island, and it's got just a weird kind of dark history to it. It seems, I saw the movie Shutter Island before I lost my sight, and it gave me, like, in my mind, I was getting very Shutter Island vibes. I know that's a caricature, but it's just, did it even dawn on you that that was a different childhood than what your peers probably had? Or were there other, you know, did you grow up around and go to school with other kids whose parents were professionals there?
Were a few other kids, and we did hang out and play together, but it was a small number. And some of them moved out, you know, as I got to be about, 7, 8, 9 years old. And for a while, it was just me, my brother, and this other kid, Hiram, who was our good friend. And we just played, you know, baseball drills basically together. We all went to school, you know, in Manhattan. And for a while, there was a van that would take all the kids into Manhattan together to, you know, go to school. And then that kind of stopped, and we took the bus, and that was a little difficult. And, you know, my mother, so one of the parts of the story that's a little bit off topic, but important, is so my biological mother died when I was very young, like around like less than 2 years old, after we moved onto the island. My father really wanted to remarry because he wanted his kids to have a mother. He went back to his hometown in Greece and met somebody that he had known a little bit when he was growing up, and she had had a similar loss. Her husband had died, didn't have any kids. She agreed to marry him and move to New York. So she came, didn't know how to drive. So she had to learn how to drive in order to pick us up at our schools, so we didn't have to like wait for the bus at 125th Street in Lexington, which is, you know, kind of known as, a place where there's a lot of drug activity and stuff like that. And was certainly known that way in the 70s when I was growing up. I did wait for the bus there many times, and, you know, but once she learned how to drive, she'd pick us up and then take us back and forth to school.
That's probably the worst possible place to have to learn how to drive is in New York City.
Well, but on Ward's Island, there was lots of space to practice. So,
So it worked
but yeah,
out.
No parallel parking and things like that. Those are difficult. There's no just, you know, pulling into a slot at the parking garage. You have to know how to parallel park.
Yeah. And so did it. I mean, because you were growing up there in the 70s, that was after Kennedy would have passed that community care act, like for that
mental health.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was still functioning and it was still a state run facility until what point?
Well, it's still a state run facility right now.
But is it a different one?
It's much smaller.
Okay.
It's much smaller. Yeah. So it was called Manhattan State Hospital. That was called Manhattan Psychiatric Center. Same place. And it's the same institution going back to New York City Asylum for the Insane, you know, which started in the 1870s. And if you read the book, you'll learn about that, you know, how it went from being run by the city to run by the state. And it's been there, you know, for that whole time. It's just smaller than it was. You know, at its peak, there were 8,000 people there. Now there's about, if you include the census of Kirby Forensic, which is in one of the three buildings, there's maybe 350 people there. So, it's much smaller, but yeah, it's still a functioning, state hospital.
Yeah. It was hard for me to track down, cause I'd seen there'd been a number of different facility names, and not being able to see the pictures, I couldn't tell if which ones were different buildings or not, and if it was entirely new facilities. But do you, I would guess your experiences there mixed with your father's background is what led you eventually to go down the career path that you went. Is that correct?
Well, interestingly, it wasn't my childhood experiences. It was my experience as a 20-year-old, where I was in college and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I had some interest in psychology just as that person that, you know, my friends would talk to me about what they were going through. You know, everyone had their struggles. A lot of friends who had psychiatric issues that weren't diagnosed, I guess, at the time. And being that person who wanted to connect with people made me think, oh, maybe, you know, psychology would be something of interest. And so I figured out a way to volunteer at the hospital at that point. And it was kind of then that I was like, oh, wait a second, these are real human beings and they're being ignored. And I really want to help and be part of, you know, making people's lives better, because this is really, really, I don't want to say a shame, but this is really a shortcoming of society to just abandon good people, you know.
Yeah,
so that's how I sort of came to it. Yeah, and I was 20, so, you know, I was prone to having a lot of idealism and stuff. And so that kind of started me on the clinical psychology path of like trying to apply and do other things to get into a program. But then after I got in to the program that I graduated from, St. John's, I got introduced to this concept of recovery from mental illness, which was a newer concept in professional circles. It was born in the lived experience movement, but it sort of came to professional awareness right around that time in 93, 94. And that kind of blew me away. And I was like, this is what I want to be a part of. And that to this day is what I sort of orient myself around, is like, how do I become someone who serves the recovery mission, you know, as a clinician, as an educator, as an advocate, as a researcher, doing all that together to, you know, give people the best chance to live in the community as well as they can.
Yeah, now I'm going to put a pin in this. I want to come back to it because I feel like my question kind of led us to skip over, I think, Ward's Island a little bit. Like,
yeah.
Did you have any standout experiences there? I mean, what was it like growing up? I know we touched on the other kids that were there, some schooling and a little bit of family stuff, but I mean, I'm so curious there had to have been a different childhood.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what was different was that, you know, we felt like we lived in a place that people didn't know about. You know, we would tell our friends about it and they didn't know where it was. And we didn't have the experience that most New Yorkers had of, you know, being in the middle of, you know, city activity. You know, we were in an isolated place, you know, and just kind of an illustration of that is an example that I briefly relate in the book, which is, you know, in 1977, there was this blackout, right, which was kind of a big deal. And, you know, I always remember how we took note of it. I think we were watching TV. I think we were watching the Yankees game. The TV started to blink, right, went off. Then all the lights in the house went out. We were like, what's going on? Is this just our house, right? And then walked outside and saw that all of Manhattan was dark because we could see the skyline sort of, and then saw that the sky was filled with stars, right? So all the lights of the city were out, and now the we could see a sky full of stars for the first time in our lives, right? So yeah. That was our experience, was like, it was this wondrous thing, you know, and then we had to light candles and everything like that. But in other parts of the city, there was like looting and, you know, it was like,
as people do. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we had a very different experience. And, you know, even though we, you know, we were living on the grounds of this place that, you know, people would say is, you know, scary, you know, for us, it was kind of like this benign, you know, experience. We didn't experience it as like, you know, we're near this hospital, stay away from it or something like that. There was a ball field that we played in at one point. And I remember that the fence that was going to be the fence that went around the what became Kirby Forensic was being put up, like this double link fence with like, you know, twisty barbed wire and stuff like that. So kind of just remember playing baseball and you know, watching that go up, you know, and not really kind of putting it together like this is ominous thing, you know.
Yeah, it's weird when it's, I mean, humans are so incredibly malleable that if that's all that you know, that's just, that might be like terrifying for someone else to see, but you don't know any different. It's just your kid and it's just your world. But what exactly was your dad doing there?
Well, so he was a ward psychiatrist. So there was a unit that he was responsible for prescribing, you know, medications for. And, you know, my dad, he's passed away many years ago, but, you know, a real character. Nobody who met him would forget him. He had like his catchphrases that he would say. So he was like, you know, a memorable psychiatrist, and he would use his charisma to kind of try to encourage people to do things that he thought were in their interest, you know, but in terms of whether it was taking their medication or not using drugs or whatever. So he had kind of like a fatherly way that generally was affected, you know. I'm sure there were some folks who, you know, were really annoyed by it, but, you know, generally I think people were inclined to want to, you know, make him happy and stuff. So I think he was an effective, you know, ward psychiatrist in that way. Yeah. He wasn't like a leader of staff. So in the state hospital, there's like all these different disciplines. There's nurses, there's social workers, there's psychologists. Mental health therapy aides is like another thing. So the psychiatrist is not like the boss, but, you know, they're an influential person in that team and they are responsible for prescribing the medication.
Okay. Did you have an interest at all in going into psychiatry instead of psychology?
I was very clear. I did not want to do it. I was not interested in medicine. Yeah. Okay. And you know, and I guess the more that I learned about it, I was like, also, especially at that time, I could see my father's job changing. So he also had a private practice that he would do after he finished his day job, where he would see people mostly from the Greek community. So as a Greek American, he was kind of trusted by Greek Americans who wanted to see a doctor who understood them, but also who understood that they wanted to keep it hush hush, because there's a lot of shame around seeing a psychiatrist. People would even call him a neurologist, right? They would sort of like pretend that he wasn't, but he clearly
dance
was
around it. Yeah.
You know, like, I'm just getting pills for my nerves, right? You know, doesn't have anything to do with my emotions or my, you know, traumatic background experiences, whatever. I can't remember your question, but I think it was basically like I could see that he was becoming less and less of a therapist, right? And more of a psychopharmacologist. And, you know, he had trained in psychoanalysis, so he had that interest. And it became largely not something he was doing any longer. So I was like, no, I don't want to be, you know, somebody's prescribing medications. Medications are good. They help people, but that's not something that I want to be, you know, involved in. So I knew that that was not my thing. Now, how did I pick psychology? I think it just seemed like, you know, the field that, you know, gave you a lot of training and, you know, I was a psychology major in college, but, you know, now I know, yeah, you can do similar things with social work and, you know, counseling and stuff like that. So it didn't have to be psychology. That's just what it turned out to be.
Yeah, that's the natural leap, though, when you're like, okay, I want to have a direct impact in administering the interventions is psychology. Most people don't know about the LCSWs and things like that. And so what is the title of your book and where can everybody find it? Of this newest book?
The newest book is called Exiles in New York City, Warehousing the Marginalized on Ward's Island. It's published by Columbia University Press. You can find it on that publisher that starts with an A. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. It has an A and M and the Z in there too. So you can find it there. You could also buy it directly from Columbia University Press. There are other online booksellers that have it. It's not in a lot of bookstores. There are a few in New York City that carry it. I've looked up online. I've seen there's some in some other big cities that carry it as well. But you're most likely to find it in online. And it's the paperback version is the one that's, you know, more reasonable. There's also a ebook version, you know, if that's something that you like. Awesome. Unfortunately, there's no audiobook, which, you know, I know makes it less accessible. And that's something that, you know, I would love the opportunity to make it one, but it's not something that was offered to me by the publisher.
Yeah, maybe if we can help boost the signal a little bit, they'll get some funds coming in and decide to do it. And that's...
Yeah. You know, I feel good about the book because I'm not just recounting history and, you know, there's original research that we did with people who live on the island in the current institutions that we, you know, summarized. But there's also a proposal for ways to change it. You know, so there's kind of like a policy proposal in it that, you know, I hope I can figure out a way to get into the hands of some people who are running for government in New York City and they can consider these proposals.
So. I can't remember if I'm thinking of what I read about you or if I'm thinking of something that our mutual friend told me. You now treat people there. You mentioned Kirby, like you see patients there, don't you?
We'll see patients who are in the hospital. I see patients who could potentially go there.
Okay.
So I work on something called a assertive community treatment team where it's the same kind of population, but, you know, people who are doing better and are living in the community in different types of settings. And, you know, there are times where someone might have a setback that might lead them to go into a state hospital.
Yeah. And I wanted to, again, I'm putting a pin in this because I want to come back to I was specifically curious about why you do in-home visits out in the community for these folks. But before, just so everyone can kind of come up to speed with us here. I mean, again, this is more in that lane of your work surrounding severe mental illnesses. Can you give a little context as to what that is? You know, I think people recognize schizophrenia and borderline personality disorder and all that stuff, but maybe if you can set a definition for us moving forward so that everyone's on the same page as we move into this stuff.
Yeah. So I guess what one way to look at it is like, if we have a broad category, like mental health conditions, right, that encompasses everything that's in the DSM-5, right? And the lifetime prevalence of having any of those conditions in the United States based on, you know, population studies is about 50%, right? So, like, you know, it's very normative for people to have experienced a mental health condition, right? And that includes things like alcohol use disorder, social anxiety disorder, some other very common ones, major depressive disorder is actually common, right? Mental health condition, because you only have to have one episode to be criteria. And a lot of people have had a depressive episode. So that's the kind of the broad category. And when we're thinking about like, who do we want to like put at the top of the list for prioritizing services, it's too many people, right? So in the policy world, you know, they decided, well, we're going to come up with a category that's people who are at the top priority list. And the first they called that group of people, they called it chronic mental illness. And then they changed it to serious and persistent mental illness. And now they call it either serious mental illness or severe mental illness. And it just basically means people who have, you know, mental health condition, usually something that involves psychotic experiences, which are things that have to do with changes in perceptions of reality, but not necessarily. So a mental health condition plus impairment, and the impairment could lead to hospitalization. It could lead to, you know, significant role impairment, like losing jobs and things like that. It could lead to being arrested. So,
can I pause you for
that
a second?
You've gotten
really quiet, Phil. Did you move away from your computer?
I didn't.
I don't know. Maybe. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry. I'm moving my hands around as I'm talking, and maybe that's made my microphone move.
Okay.
Can't help it. You know.
You're fine. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so when we set those criteria, it's about 5%, right, of the country, you know, meets those criteria. You know, that's still a large number of people, right? You know, that have a serious mental illness. It's not an insignificant number. You know, and if you think about a place, the 350 million people in the U.S., right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, what is it, 17 and a half million? Am I doing my math right?
Better than me. I'm not going to question your math. I'm a Marine, man. You don't want me doing math. Yeah.
Yeah. So in New York City, you know, that city of about 8 million people, right? It's about 400,000 people. So, you know, that's a very large number of people, right? So again, when we're thinking of, like, when people throw around terms like the mentally ill, you know, you're talking about your neighbors, you're talking about your family members. You know, these are people who you interact with in some way, because, you know, these numbers indicate that it's likely that you've met somebody who, you know, has this status and you just don't know it.
Yeah. And I've been very surprised out in public, I guess, and it's made me question. I don't know when I became aware that schizophrenia doesn't mean that you are not automatically violent and people need to be worried about you murdering people, or that borderline personality disorder wasn't having multiple that split personalities and having that all these things are treatable and manageable. And it's again, I don't know where I learned that wasn't the case, but it still seems to be very common when it comes up in conversation, like specifically, you know, when I've hung out with our mutual friend who is in that, works in that space. It's, you know, when she discusses what she does for work and it comes up, and people are like shocked when it gets to discussions of people actually being treated for some of these things, and specifically that the word treatment comes up, that there is something to do about it. And with that, like, that also made me curious with you coming back to you going out into the community to administer treatment and help people through these, start to overcome and adapt to these illnesses that they do have. Is that because they are so affected that you are having to go to them, or is this just what's the reasoning for that?
So the treatment model of assertive community treatment came out of this belief that we kind of owe it to people to do whatever we can to reduce barriers to engaging in services. And it was found that there's a subset of people who, you know, if you just give them a piece of paper with an appointment, you know, to go to an outpatient clinic, you know, for reasons related to stigma and other things, they're not going to go, right? And then you're going to kind of lose that person. And maybe it's going to increase the likelihood that something negative is going to occur. But if you go the extra mile to connect with them and meet with them, you know, on their own turf, that you can keep them engaged. That's where this model of assertive community treatment came from. And I got involved with the team that I work with when it was part of an organization called Pathways to Housing, which developed this housing first model that's now actually being attacked by the federal government, that they paired offering people independent housing with assertive community treatment. And the idea was that, you know, they were going to do whatever was necessary to engage people in services to make it likely that they would succeed in their independence. So I got the opportunity to work with one of the teams, and I just kind of really found that I really loved the, you know, opportunity to engage with people in their you know, environment, home environments where they live and hang out. And I was never uncomfortable with it. And, you know, I got to know people as people and, you know, in a way that, you know, there's kind of like a sense of them be kind of family, you know, since I've been seeing some of them for many years and for, you know, I'm in their home environments and stuff like that. So they don't know. Yeah. They don't know my family, but they, you know, they feel like I'm a family member of theirs, I guess, in a sense.
Oh, that's a very intimate thing for someone to be opening up and getting assistance through something like that, specifically because there is, I mean, I get weird reactions even just talking about my depression and my suicide attempt sometimes, even like, and it depends on the setting. You know, it's weird. Like I had a speaking engagement last night, spoke to a huge bunch of people were lined up to talk to me afterwards, and not a single bad interaction. Everyone was curious. Some people were opening up about their own issues, and some people were just like, hey, thanks, so like this stuff needs to be talked about. But every once in a while there's a person who's like, it's, I don't know how much of it is a lack of empathy or like that ability to have empathy for others or try and put yourself in other people's shoes, or just this, you know, obviously until you've been through things, and myself included, I had very strong beliefs on suicide and depression, and until you've been through that. So I don't know how much of it is that and just not having experience or not having been around someone who has experienced it before. But I would imagine, you know, these people probably, if it's schizophrenia, the number of people that you've told that you have schizophrenia is probably so, so small that when you guys are there, it's refreshing to actually just be able to talk about all of it and whatever is going on and not have to tuck that away.
Yeah. Have it be accepted and seen as part of your life, but not your what defines you. Right.
Yeah.
I think what you're pointing at is that, until you couldn't avoid it, right, because of the nature of what happened to you made it something that could not be hidden, right? You were running away from this, you know, from yourself, right? And I think that's human nature to do that, especially for somebody who, you know, is involved in, you know, something that has a lot of strong, you know, toughness to it, right? Which we tend to think of that as being a male thing, but there are women who have that as part of their kind of self-definition, right? You know, being the one who works and takes care of the kids, supports their parents and all that. So if you've got that as part of you and this thing is happening that makes you feel like you are not able to maintain that, you know, it can be a real struggle. And that's when you have these times when it just kind of becomes an overwhelming thing for a person. So that's a story for a lot of people, you know. And when you talk to people and you find out their backgrounds, often there is that whole thing of how they were holding all these things together, you know, before, you know, things came to a crisis point.
You see that even in the realm of serious mental illnesses?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've met people who have had doctorates and, you know, have worked very high paying jobs. And it can, you know, it's quite difficult to recover from that big a loss, right? If you've had that type of achievement in your life, and then you wind up in a hospital and you feel like you're completely laid low by, I guess.
Yeah, your identity has been totally upended.
Yeah. And of course, with the recovery philosophy, it's that, like, yeah, you can find a way to live with this, you know, if you factor it into your life, right? And, you know, I have many friends and colleagues who are living examples of that. But when you grew up with those negative stereotypes that you described for me, it can be so hard to reconcile that, you know. That how could that be me that has that?
Yeah. And I want to come back specifically to the I think that's the second time we've made it specifically to recovery. And I wanted to ask you a question specifically about that as well. But yeah. With when you guys are going, is it you paired with a psychiatrist, because medications are often a part of these treatments, right? Like, is that what's the team like when you're in this setting?
Yeah. So you go on your own. You can go with other people too, but you know, generally once you develop the rapport with somebody, you go on your own, and you know, you can help connect them to others. There's a lot of communication, you know, between the team members, but you're not seeing people only with others present.
Okay. And so now coming back to the recovery thing, I'm curious, because that's something you emphasized in the notes that you sent me. That's something you've emphasized a couple times here, is recovery from serious mental illness. And I'm curious, because these are lifelong things. I think you already hinted at it, and I want to kind of pull this out of you more. What exactly do you mean by that? Because it's not something that goes away.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I'm at a conference right now that's called Refocus on Recovery, and the folks who leading this conference are like very involved in a particular definition of recovery. They call it the CHIME model, and I think it's connectedness, hope. I'm forgetting what the I is, but then meaning and empowerment. I think identity. I is identity, meaning, empowerment. But so there's kind of like this debate about like, so recovery as outcome, right, versus recovery as process. And recovery as outcome means getting a job, having friends, you know, having a lot of social connections, things that, you know, we tend to value, I guess, in society. And recovery as process has to do with hope, empowerment, having a different identity, not being defined by your mental illness, things like that. So different people kind of emphasize different sides of it more. But I'd say within the lived experience community, the focus tends to be more on the identity process, you know, redefining yourself part of it.
And getting to a place
one thing
where...
that's clear, yeah, it doesn't mean no symptoms, right? So the definition that was articulated back in the early 90s was living a satisfying life despite, you know, despite symptoms, right? So managing them such that you're able to achieve things in life that you want. So it doesn't mean that we've cured people of symptoms, but they're managing them either through medications or through their own coping strategies that they use, that they figured out, or that we've taught them, or they've learned from others.
And you said something very important there, and that's I'm pretty positive I've talked about it on here. I know I've talked about it quite a bit when I go on other podcasts or and have other opportunities where I'm the one being interviewed. Like this, you know, the people that I have on this show are not the kinds of people who are making or using their situations as excuses for things. But I do hear people doing that in daily life and see people doing that where it's, oh, well, I have X thing. That is why I'm doing Y thing. This bad thing that I'm doing, oh, it's because of this. And it's not, it's people being unwilling to learn how to recognize how whatever that ailment is presents in them and how to recognize it. And when it comes up, not circumvent, but maybe redirect or counteract or adjust for it accordingly, which is, that's why I mentioned as I started asking you about that, like you had started to touch on it. And then I think I said we were going to put a pin in it. And I'm so glad that you touched on that, because it bothers me that seems to be a trend in society, that people use things like this as an excuse. And I'm curious though, as you being that making it to the correct side of that is where you're at. Is it a struggle that you come across a lot in having to get people from that place of making the excuses and getting into a place where they can actually live effectively, like you said, despite whatever it is that they have?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't use the word excuses because that suggests some kind of value judgment. But I think what we're getting at, what you're pointing toward, is this kind of double-edged sword of an identity that's connected to something that you know, might be devalued, right, by others. And when you identify that as part of you, that can be a good thing because you're not hiding from it, you're not running from it any longer, right? But if you, along with that acceptance or that identification with it, you take on all of those negative stereotypes and you kind of endorse them, then you're going to buy into that, you know, role, right? And so it could be kind of the patient role as like a passive person, or it could be, you know, a person who's given up, you know, on their aspirations and stuff. So one of the things that we did when we started researching this, when I say we, I mean Paul Lysacker and David Rowe, they were colleagues of mine. Paul passed away a couple of years ago. David is still someone I actively work with. We came up with this, what we called this illness identity model, where we determined that if you identified, you know, as having a mental illness and you rejected the negative stereotypes, right? So like low self-stigma is what we called it. You know, then it was associated with positive outcomes, right? But if you accepted having mental illness and you bought into the negative stereotypes, then it was even worse than not accepting the mental illness at all, right? So kind of we tend to think of like someone being in denial as being, you know, a really bad thing. But in some ways, there's advantages to that over buying into it and believing all of this, the stigma, because that means that you are a completely disempowered person. Now, I don't blame people for being in this situation because it's a symptom of the society we live in which people are taught these things when they grow up. And even the mental health system is partly to blame for it because sometimes people were directly told these things by their doctors or their therapists: give up on your aspirations, avoid stress. So, you know, I don't blame anybody for that, but it is a problematic situation. And that's why we got into the whole addressing self-stigma, you know, thing with narrative enhancement cognitive therapy, which you mentioned when you introduced me, you know. And so that's kind of been a defining part of my research mission, was to kind of figure out how we could help people, you know, change their identity, you know, from disempowered person to person who had hope and maybe even saw some meaning in having the mental illness, right? So, you know, finding meaning in it kind of could be something like what you've done, which is you've turned this thing that happened to you into a way to connect with others and to show them that you can, you know, overcome this, even when it changes your life in a fundamental way, right? I hope I'm not assuming things, you know, I'm just...
No, you're hitting the nail on the head with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's an amazing thing if you can help someone to find meaning, right? I wouldn't push that on anybody because some people will see that as like really, you know, invalidating, I guess, of the suffering that they experience. Mm. But if you can work with someone alongside them to help them find that, you know, it can be really transformative for them to find meaning and what they've been through, and maybe it being something they can use to help others, right? Make the world a better place, you know, advocate, reform systems that bring people down. So all of those things are things that can happen when someone redefines, you know, this condition. And, you know, I've seen people do amazing things with that, and it really can energize them to, you know, do all this is hard advocacy work. So yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to do, but we're trying to do it in a way that's not like preachy or, you know, because people are very sensitive to being, you know, told that it's, you know, it's just easy, just do it this way or something.
Yeah, being talked at is never a good way to teach people generally. And that's when I was reading, you guys have a paper published that was kind of, I guess it was announcing this modality, or I'm not sure if it was announcing or if it was just your, you know, I don't know how developing something like this and getting it out into the zeitgeist works. And so my terminology here is probably not correct. And I want to ask you about how that process works as well. But when I was reading that, like the research that you had seen or that you referenced, it was like, hey, yes, no one's ever really tried to approach the self-stigmatizing in this way. It's always been more in an educational format where it does sound like it's us telling you as opposed to showing you, whereas you guys have come at it from a different angle of more of a peer support model and doing kind of like what you just said, where you get people starting to be able to turn that around a little bit in the way, I mean, it's all tying into everything that we've kind of talked about, where people can take ownership's not the right word, but find acceptance of where they're at and start to look more outwards with it. Is that a fair way to put that?
Really? Yeah. I mean, so when we started wanting to do an intervention, you know, there wasn't anything else out there. Other people were actually having similar ideas. So there was sort of a confluence around a certain time where us and a couple other people put stuff out. But, you know, our idea was that this whole thing is wrapped up in your kind of your story, right? The stories that you tell yourself, stories you tell other people. So we had this narrative thing to be a big part of it. You know, and our idea was that it should happen in a group, you know, where you're sharing it to others, and then you're getting them to ask you questions and give you feedback on your story. And that gives you the opportunity to kind of reconsider some parts of that, right? So that was our take on it. And we wanted it to be something that the person wrote it and then they read it. Interestingly, at this conference now where I'm at, this group here in the UK has a whole thing built around people reading or listening to other people's stories online, right? So they have this thing, it's called Neon. And it's basically a platform where you can go in and you can find a story that kind of matches you based on your background experiences and listen to it. And then they see what the effect is of that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like another way of trying to bring narrative into this. But our thing was, we were thinking about people who were in the mental health system who were not going to go into in front of a computer, you know, and you can engage them in a group and getting people to open up about these parts of themselves by telling stories was the way that we identified an opportunity to open that up, and that it would be facilitated through, you know, people who are trained and trying to get people to ask certain kinds of questions that, of course, be supportive. So that was where we were coming from with it. And, you know, it's been really cool because it went from being this thing that we created with federal support and just did, you know, in our research, to something that's now it's available online. Anyone can use it. You know, I've done a lot of different trainings. It's been translated. I know that there's some places where it's been done a lot, like in Sweden. You know, it's become kind of part of the standard system of care. You know, that's really nice to, you know, that's something that you worked on, you know, that you had an idea can maybe bring relief to people somewhere. And, you know, I've met some people who've said that it's had a big impact on them. And that's very meaningful for me, of course. You know, it's like, I didn't do that therapy myself, but, you know, I'd provided a framework for someone else to offer that. So that gets beyond, you know, it goes past what I can do just as one person.
Yeah, and it's something that will be around for years and years and years to come, hopefully, which is neat. And that's, is that as you, to build something like that out, I mean, is it like the standard publishing kind of process that you would do with any other research that you were doing in the space where, you know, you through the scientific method and everything, you do your research, you publish your findings, and then it's out there for people to rebut and try and reproduce. And as they were able to reproduce results, then it starts getting pushed out? Or is it a different process entirely?
Kind of like what you said, because the kind of the standard for determining that something is evidence-based, right? You might hear that from around, means that it was supported by more than one independent research group, right? So it's sort of like if I do like five studies and it's all me, you know, and they all find support, you know, that might, there might be some suspiciousness there about like, oh, well, is he like, is it just, you know, that he has his magic touch or something like that, or he's cooking the books in some kind of way. So if it's being studied in multiple independent randomized control trials, and they're finding similar pattern findings, you know, that suggests that, you know, this is something that's consistent. So, you know, once it started getting studied by, you know, people in Sweden or Taiwan or France, you know, then I think we were able to be more confident that this is evidence-based because it's kind of, you know, holds up past what we could do on our own.
Yeah, so like at this conference now, are you there presenting on this work specifically?
I'm actually not. I'm here to support a PhD student who's presenting other research that he's done, but I'm also here just to hang out with like-minded peers from all around, you know, Europe and Asia. There's people from Japan here, you know, Singapore, you know, just kind of share our, you know, passion for helping facilitate recovery.
Yeah. How long have you been actually overseeing the PhD candidate?
So I did it for 5 years, and then I'm into my second year of doing it again. So we're, you know, about 7 years.
Why'd you stop in between?
Well, I felt it was important for it to be something that other people had the opportunity to do. I could sort of see that people were seeing me as like, oh, he's competent, you know, he could just keep doing this. But I also think, you know, I also have the idea that, like, you know, I'm a white male and I don't want to just be, you know, sitting in a position of authority forever. You know, I want to give other people a chance to step in. And it was a great, you know, person who was ready to do it. And tragically, she passed away. You know, wonderful colleague. It needed to be someone coming back in who was ready to do the job, because we were going to go through reaccreditation site visit. You know, so I sort of saw that it was, you know, my responsibility to come back in. And others said that they were happy that I was willing to do that. So, you know, it's a nice position because you get to work with great, you know, emerging, you know, professionals, your future colleagues and peers, and, you know, support them. And, you know, they're dealing with all the stressors of being in a very demanding program while, you know, growing up. You know, generally people are in their 20s and, you know, it's a turbulent time of life anyway. But, you know, usually people are up for it and it goes well. And you get to feel good that you've helped, you know, get people to where they want to go in their careers and do some good in the world. So I can feel good about that too, I guess. I had the opportunity to be kind of like a grandfather, I guess, on like one of the former mentees was mentoring a student at another institution, like for dissertation, and I got to be on the committee, you know, so I was sort of like the intellectual grandfather for that person. So that's kind of cool to see that the torch has been passed, you know, a second time.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to ask you about it, because it seems so, I mean, just what a cool position to be in, that you're shaping the next generation. But you said something that caught me a little off guard. Why would you being, I mean, you're a very accomplished psychologist. You've done a lot of work in this space. Why would you being a white male mean that you need to step away from a position that you're good at?
Kind of the idea of like hogging things and not making space, right? Because people don't have an opportunity unless there's a space. You know, I mean, that assumes that it's something that somebody wants, right? A lot of people in the community of directors of clinical training talk about it like, this isn't necessarily a job that people want because they see it as like a lot of work. Yeah. But, you know, it could be. And so, you know, you want to make sure people know that they have that chance to move in to it. And, you know, you want to open the space for the next generation. And, you know, it's not like I was dying to stay in the position forever either. So,
yeah, you know. I get that. But why does being a white male play a role in that is what I'm curious about.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers in academia are interesting. So especially in psychology, right? So like, you may notice that the majority of young psychologists are female, right? The numbers in our programs they're overwhelmingly female in terms of coming into the field. But in terms of like leadership positions, it doesn't reflect that. Men are still predominantly in these leadership positions. It might have something to do with some of the things that happen during people's careers that lead women to leave academic positions earlier. There might be, you know, ways in which they feel that they're not being supported adequately. There's a bunch of different things that have been talked about. I'm just sort of saying, like, from my position as somebody who has that ability to make a space, you know, if I see that it's something that somebody who's, you know, close to me at that level of seniority is ready for, that I feel that I can offer that space. Again, the person who was going to take the position was extremely well qualified, extremely ready, you know, very well suited to the whole role of supporting students. So it was, seemed like the right thing to do at that point.
Yeah.
Make it available. And it's not like they were dying to do it either. I kind of have to talk them into it, but you know, once they committed to it, they were ready, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's an incredible responsibility. Because how many, typically at one time, how many future doctors do you have under you?
About 25.
Wow.
So, you know, because it's sort of 5 years and there's about five per cohort. It could be a little bit more. It could be like 27, 28 or something like that, but it's about 25. And again, everybody's getting that individualized attention to some extent. I tend to pay more attention to people who are starting out and people who are finishing, right? So people are starting out, you know, they're adjusting. People are finishing, they're applying for something called internship. It's kind of like their culminating experience. So I kind of pay most attention to folks at those ends of things. But yeah, I mean, they have other advisors. I'm not the only one, but you are kind of like dad to the whole, you know, group of people in a sense. Yeah. So it helps to have a dad mentality, which, you know, as a dad I have. So, you know,
that's, I was about like to ask if you have kids.
I can do that. Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome, man. Did any of them have any of them? I don't know if they're old enough. Have they followed in your footsteps?
Neither has expressed any interest. Yeah. So one is going to turn 23 soon, and he is doing something really different, doing urban planning. But he's really interested in academic stuff, and we're actually going to work on some things together related to exiles in your city, because the last chapter of the book involves like planning proposal for new housing and stores and things like that. So he's actually going to mock up some of the designs, you know,
as
he's
been trained. That is cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to present that at a conference in Chicago in November and then in New Zealand later that month. So, you know, but he's not interested in being a therapist, whatever, but they have total respect for it. And I definitely drilled into them all the anti-stigma stuff growing up, which they've been very supportive to all their friends. You know, every time anybody who had any mental health issues, they were super supportive. They got that, you know, drummed into them pretty hard for me. And they didn't react against it. They took it as a responsibility. So
that's beautiful.
So that
man.
I'm very proud. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We need more just people who are willing to be understanding and set some stuff aside and just listen and be there for people. I think that would, if there were more people like that, the world would end up in a, at least in a little bit of a better place, right? We'd end up less despair and less of these situations where we lose people to that feeling of hopelessness because they can't, they think they can't get through it. And, you know, unfortunately at the end of the day, that does, like in my position, I'm the reason that I got to where I was because I wasn't speaking up. And that's the sad part about it, is that people have to let others know that they are struggling before they can receive the help. But the more people that we get out there who are willing to help, the better. And it's just, that's neat that you've been able to shape them, even though they don't go down the same path as you, to still instill those values in them. So that's, and I'm excited to hear, I'm hoping that you follow up with me here in the next year or two and tell me that there's an audiobook, because I would love to listen to this.
No, I'd love to figure out how to make that happen. But I also will send you, so I have started a book adjacent podcast called Exiles in the City. And so you can definitely listen to those.
Okay, awesome. Because I'm a programmer and a writer, so I listen to my computer read things to me aloud in a robotic voice all day. So like, I don't like listening to my books that way. So the podcast and the audiobook would be great. But people, and I'll link to all your stuff in the show notes. What else? What have we? Have I missed anything that you would like to talk about?
The only other thing that would be interesting, that's sort of kind of on a tangent, is you know, kind of my own sort of personal mental health story is, you know, I had my own struggles, and you know, kind of music, you know, was kind of my salvation, I guess. You know, it wasn't psychology, it wasn't therapy specifically, it was like getting involved in like indie punk alternative rock and playing it, and you know, connecting with people in that community who were supportive and accepting of me, who I was, you know, didn't see me as like some weird freak who, you know, didn't have the courage to talk to anyone or something like that, right? But they saw me as like a cool guy who was quiet and intense or something. So that was all like really important to me personally. And so I still do it, you know, I still play in bands. And I also got, one of the things I wrote after I did my first book was I did a bunch of blog posts, and I wrote one about punk rock, and it was called like Punk Rock and the Dream of the Accepting Community, I believe, if I'm reading correctly. And a guy who just found it online contacted me, and he has a podcast called Scream Therapy, and he wrote a book that he was working on at the time. So he interviewed me for it. So I was in it. And then he was like, hey, I really want to try to get in touch with this guy, Sasha Dubrule, who I know as a friend. And he hadn't been able to get in touch with him, and I connected them. And then that became like a formative part of the book, because Sasha is a really intense, you know, thinker. And you know, he blew his mind, and that became kind of like a big part of the book. And so that's another thing that I've been involved with, that it's been kind of gratifying for me in the last few years to kind of be able to share more about it. And so this experience with being in screen therapy kind of like helped me, you know, feel like it was okay to bridge these two worlds of like rock and roll and, you know, mental health, because, you know, they do have something to do with each other. as much as they might seem to be unrelated.
It's absolutely expression. I think if people can't see that parallel, they aren't thinking about it hard enough. Like it's an outlet, and it is, you know, sometimes not being so direct about things is what helps open a door to be more direct down the road about it. And it's, what is it? I mean, with screen therapy, I've heard of it, and I've seen, I think, like anyone else, doom scrolling on Instagram or whatever, you know, pictures of people out in the woods just screaming at the top of their lungs in groups, like in the circle and stuff like that. But is that, yeah, obviously that's a, you know, a 30 seconds of it, but is that what is going on? Is there's a facilitator and there's guided screaming, like just at the primal?
It's just a name he picked because, you know, obviously there's often screaming and in punk rock and stuff like that. So he just picked that as his name, but he just interviews people who are in bands and have mental health issues or do some kind of therapeutic work or whatever, and are in both those worlds about it, you know?
Okay.
So, yeah, but I guess the idea is that it is therapeutic to scream, you know, but when you're doing it over music, you know, you're making it you're putting it in a context that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, because you're doing it over drums and bass and guitars, and maybe there's word that you're screaming and, you know, you're giving it meaning, right?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I had mistook. I think, I know you had, mentioned at the beginning of that his project was scream therapy, and then at the end you said something of when I participated in scream therapy, and I think I took those as two separate things instead of closing the loop, but that makes sense. Are you wearing like Green Day eyeliner right now?
No, that's never been my version of punk. My version of punk has always been come as you are, you know, and be who, you know, look the way you look, you know. Yeah, that was my ideal of a punk rocker was, if you've seen a picture of Minor Threat, you see Lyle Pressler, who is the guitar player, and he's just wearing like what he wore to school that day, right? Because they were teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, that's my ideal of a punk rocker, is just like a nerdy guy or girl or non-binary person who, you know, is just being who they are, and it's not like putting on a show, right? For others, I understand for other people, it's like about like accentuating your otherness through makeup or tattoos or piercings or whatever. That's cool. But my ideal was about like being that kid that nobody pays attention to, that they think of, and then seeing that person on stage and being like, whoa, that person has a lot to express, you know, artistically and emotionally.
Yeah, that's cool, man. I'm more of a metal person, but if I was going to check out some punk stuff, would Minor Threat be the recommendation?
Well, Minor Threat definitely impacted a lot of metal. Like, so, you know, the phase of metal that, you know, in the 80s called thrash, right? Which Metallica came out of, that was influenced by hardcore punk, right? Which, you know, Bad Brains, Minor Threat, Circle Jerks, those bands, you know, had a huge influence on Metallica, you know, Exodus, you know, all of the early first wave of what became known as thrash. We actually call it speed metal at the time. That's kind of been forgotten. We call it speed metal. Now it's called thrash. But so thrash, you know, was metal chops with punk speed, and then the vocal style was pretty influenced by a lot of the more screamy kind of singing, you know. But if you listen to Minor Threat's first two 7 inches, right, which is like, I think it's like 8 songs, right? That they crammed into these 7 inches. It'll blow your mind because the first two songs are become like one song, you know, just going from filler to, no, wait a second. Yeah, I think that's the first. Listen to it. Even if you are not a, you know, not a punk person, I think you'll be really impressed by the delivery of it.
Yeah, I'm going to be picking heavy things up and putting heavy things back down in the gym at 3:30 tomorrow morning. So I'll check it out and, and let you know, man.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's awesome.
It'll only take 15 minutes to go through it, but okay. Yeah, you can find it on YouTube. You can,
Awesome, man. Can you tell everyone again where to find your book? I know Amazon, but tell everyone the title one more time. I will have links to it in the show notes.
Exiles in New York City, Warehousing and Marginalized on Ward's Island, Columbia University Press is the publisher. You can find it through online publishers. If you're in New York, you can find it at independent bookstores that are carrying it. The big chain bookstores are not, for whatever reason. If you're interested in history and you're interested in policy and maybe ways that we can consider changing things, especially in urban spaces, I think it'll speak to you. So, and Written Off was the previous book that I wrote that was published by Cambridge University Press, and you can find it online as well.
Okay, awesome. And I'd love to pick your brain more on that stuff, but I know you said you wanted to get out of here within an hour and a half, and I think we're at about an hour 15 right now. So I want to let you go and thank you for coming on and giving me this chunk of your time. I know it's not easy to carve that out, so I do appreciate you. And yeah, keep me posted on any other big stuff. I'd love to hear how this conf or these presentations go with your son and hear where things go with these policies.
Thank you so much, Zach. Anytime you want me to come on, I'll be happy to find time.
All right. Awesome. Thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Again, please leave a rating and review wherever you're listening right now. And if that happens to be on YouTube, subscribe to the channel. And remember, someone out there needs to hear these conversations. So share this thing around, and I'll see you next time.